So we'll talk with Lionel. I'll talk with Lionel anyway, and then I'll open up the phones coming up at the bottom of the hour, and you can join the conversation too. We sort of transitioned into the book that's coming out, which I can't have read yet, but I look forward to it. Forever in My Veins, How Film Led Me to the Mysterious World of the African Shaman. And Lionel was just talking about growing up as a boy in apartheid South Africa, and how while often with his nanny, she would take him to circles that not every white privileged South African boy would travel, and saw the local medicine woman, the doctor who was working with the with women, and especially using like bones on the middle of the floor. And that's just where we had to stop the story before the top of the hour. So did you have an ailment, by the way, that she happened, your nanny happened to bring you to this woman, or you were just observing?
No, I didn't. The woman who was practicing the medicine, as she explained it to me, was merely a friend of the woman who worked for us. So she was basically going to see her friend. I think it was her afternoon off. And she said, you want to come with me? We go for a walk. We go and see my friends. So, of course, I was an only child, and I was only too happy to do that. And what that did for me, seeing those bones lying on that grass mat in this little room and seeing all these weird herbs and whatever else on these shelves, you know, piqued my curiosity. I wanted to know what she used them for, how she used them. And I asked, I said, well, how do you use this? And her answer to me was, they allow me to speak to my ancestors. And through my ancestors, I can tell about an illness. I can tell the future. I can help people in many ways. And that's all she basically told me. But I was utterly intrigued. It opened my mind there and then. I think, as I said to you earlier, I was about maybe 6 or 7 years old. And suddenly I realized, wow, there's got to be more than, you know, I've been exposed to or that my white friends know about. What is going on here, and what kind of medicine is she talking about? Normally, someone like her would merely be dispensed with the derogatory term as a witch doctor. You know,
right.
the old derogatory term that was always used those days was, it's a witch doctor. You know, someone wears skins and has rattles and
masks and jumps around.
Yeah, you know,
right.
And that's all they did. But this woman could help people in so many ways. She could cure illness. She could foretell an event that was to come. She could answer questions like, for example, what had happened to a husband. A husband had gone missing. She could tell them where this person had gone or whether the person was arrested for not having his papers in order, all kinds of things. And she said to me that all of this is done through the ancestors. And, you know, when I went back and I spoke to my parents about it, of course, they knew nothing about any of this stuff. And so,
how did they react?
Well, they said, "Oh, that's very nice, but you know, but you know, no real questions, because who paid attention to black servants anyway? You know,
right.
what did they know?"
Right.
But it made me a very, very curious individual, and we can fast forward now a couple of decades, where my folks eventually left South Africa. They moved to a place called Northern Rhodesia. Northern Rhodesia today is the Republic of Zambia, and it sits right in the middle of Central Africa, right on the southern perimeter of the Congo. And my father went up there for a number of reasons. The primary one was to get away from the apartheid system. And he went up there to run a store as a job. He was a watchmaker by trade. He immigrated to South Africa from Latvia, and he was trained as a watchmaker. And he took a job as a little trading store up there in a mining community where there were all these copper mines. It was called.
Okay, but wait, you talk about like some of the horrors of Africa. First of all, Rhodesia being named after whoever Rhodes. What was that guy's name?
Cecil Rhodes. One of the great imperialists of all time, yes.
Right, so it wasn't apartheid, but there was a heavy amount of imperialism going on.
Well,
and weren't the mines just as bad as the way apartheid treated?
They were, but without the really vicious side of apartheid, because it was not ordained in the law books. It was not legally required that there would be no communication between black and white. But, of course, there was, because the whites always felt superior to the black community anyway.
Right, right.
And remember that this is the tail end of the British Empire. And the empire days of the British, you know, they were pretty arrogant. And as they colonized the world, all the way from India to Africa and Burma and wherever else they had their colonies, you know, they were pretty arrogant about it and looked down upon the locals.
Oh, yeah.
So it was an entrenched way of life and a way of seeing local indigenous people. And this is what I went to after when my folks moved up there. I finished my education. I went with them. And when I arrived there, there was this little tiny town in the string of copper mines. And I thought, what on earth am I going to do with my life here? I mean, I'm in the middle of darkest Africa.
Right.
But I'd always made movies, and I'd been making movies since I was 11 years old. I fell in love with the movies. I fell in love with Hollywood. I fell in love with Esther Williams.
Oh, funny.
When I was 5 years old.
Of all people.
And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make films with Esther Williams and Red Skelton, with her coming out of, you know, swimming pools and Esther
right.
and Red Skelton doing funny things. That's what I wanted to do. So I did that as a child. In 8mm film, this is long before the days of video.
Right.
And so when I moved up there, I thought, well, you know, okay, it's great. I'll have a camera and I'll make movies, but I am not going to be able to make the African Queen or King Solomon's Mines. How am I going to do? What am I going to do here? And it was like manna from heaven just after we arrived in this godforsaken small town in this mining community that there was an ad in the local paper for staff for a new television station that was opening. And it was, for me, like a magic door.
Yeah, really.
I was there, and I knocked on that door, and I said, I don't care what you do. I will pay you to employ
me. Right.
And I did get a job there. And so that's where my career began. The very, very first television station in Central Africa.
And well, but wait, you could have made King Solomon's Mines, right?
Well, I couldn't make King Solomon's Mines if I was a lot older than I was.
Right, I'm just saying. Of all the films you mentioned, that's like one you actually could have remade, I think, with an 8mm camera. So you go from there, then eventually, I mean, success, you go to Hollywood. Yeah. What brought you back?
Well, let me just tell you this. This is what's key to the, and this is the through line of my book,
okay.
Forever in My Veins, is because I worked for this television station for like 3 years. And then, well, the British Empire was falling apart, and Britain was giving all its colonies independence. And it gave Northern Rhodesia independence, and that's how it became the Republic of Zambia. But the minute that happened, all of the white people who worked at the station were given, it was privately, and was taken over by the state, and the state said, okay, you white guys, you've done a great job, but thank you very much, we don't need you anymore, out.
Right.
And
right.
So we all lost our jobs, and we had to give our jobs over to local people, which was totally understandable. None of us questioned it, but we were all shocked about it.
Sure.
But then I thought, what am I going to do? And so that's how I eventually left the country. But when I told... We had a guy working for us at that time, a man by the name of David Fury. And I said to him, David, he was a black guy of the Bemba tribe, wonderful man. And I said to him, David, you know, I've been fired. And he said, why? I said, because my job is going to be taken over by, you know, one of you guys, by a Zambian. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. What are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. What do you suggest I do? And he said, I will take you to someone who will tell you what to do.
Right.
And he took me to see a Zambian shaman. In Zambia, they go by the name of Ngangas, Nganga. And I went to see this little shriveled little lady who lived in a mud hut on the outskirts of town. And she threw the bones for me. And she said, my ancestors will tell me about what is going to happen in my future. And she threw the bones. And it was the most extraordinary experience of my life. I was 22 years old, and every single thing that woman told me that day, thank goodness for David, because he interpreted every word she said. She didn't
know
English. Every single thing she told me has come true. That's 60 years ago.
That's amazing. Now, back up just a little bit. Was there any difference in her shamanistic approach or the liturgical experience of talking to that shaman versus the woman you had originally, as you remembered her as a small boy, in South Africa?
No, it looked pretty much the same. Because what I remember more vividly than anything was the grass hut on the floor, the bones lying there and all the little accoutrements and packages right. and canisters and whatever else on shelves right. in dark corners of the room. You know, that's, and of course I'd only met the other one when I was a child. Now I'm a young adult.
Yeah.
And now this woman is going to give me some indication as to what's going to happen in my life. Well, the stuff she told me was absolutely extraordinary.
Like
amazing.
What? Like what?
Well, for example, she said, and the word she used was not that you will emigrate to another country. She would say things like this, and she was talking in Bemba to David, and he was, you know, she was rattling away, and he was talking to me as fast as he could, trying to explain what she was saying. Now, she said, you will cross the big waters. Mm-hmm. You will cross the big waters, and there will be many big lights, very strong lights in your life. You will cross the big waters, and you will go up that way. And she points to the north. Now, what are the big waters? Zambia is a landlocked country. There's no ocean there. She's never seen the ocean in her life, this little lady living in a mud hut, you know, in the middle of the boondocks. But she says, I will cross the big waters. I will go in that direction. There will be many big lights, and I will meet many, many famous people. These are the words she's using, you know, and she's telling David all these things. And then I'm just going to give you a couple of other things she told me.
Yeah,
she said,
please.
I will almost be killed one day by a great beast. And I thought, what on earth is she talking about? A great beast. You will almost die from this great beast. And then she said things like, you will one day go to a world where there is no color in this world. There is no color in that place at all. It is only white. You will go to that world, and you will do your work there. I had no idea what she was talking about. And then she said things to him like, this is one of the most significant stories, and I talk about this in great detail in the book. She says to David that I will one day meet a man who was one of the closest friends of the most evil man who has ever lived. I'm writing this stuff down not knowing what on earth she's referring to. I had no idea what she was referring to. But as these events came to pass, I realized, my God, what she was talking about. Like, for example, she also said to me, be very, very, very careful of the great waters, because the great waters will also try to take your life. And, you know, I was on a research vessel in the South Atlantic that almost capsized at sea. I was on a trawler that was off the coast of Angola, and we were trapped in this unbelievable storm for 72 hours. It should have taken us 24 hours to get to shore, and we nearly died. The Great Beast is the story of an elephant that charged me behind my camera in Mozambique and was shot about 6 feet away before she reached me. So all of these
was things, that when you were working for National Geographic?
No, this was actually a job that I did for a guy called Spud Millen. He had a company called Whammo Toys here in California.
Sure.
And he made his fortune out of the hula hoop, for
right.
those who remember those days.
Yeah.
And he also made another fortune out of inventing the Frisbee.
Right. Well, didn't he buy the Frisbee? Because it was originally, wasn't it by some students in Boston or something, wasn't it? They were tossing.
It was actually, if I remember correctly, it was being used by some obscure group somewhere. But he developed it so that it was, you know, lightweight and
sure.
throw it and would go a long distance. He made a fortune. And what he did was he went to Mozambique with two of his buddies, a stockbroker and a lawyer from LA. He went to Mozambique on a hunting safari, and I was offered the job to do a film about that safari. And that's why I went to Mozambique with him. And it was on that particular trip that one of the hunters tried to shoot an elephant and missed. And the elephant, it was actually a cow, not the one that he was trying to shoot, but a female elephant guarding a baby. She started to chase, to storm us. She wanted to attack us because she knew that her baby's life was in danger. And I was behind this heavy camera, and there was a guy behind me holding a wet cell battery. I mean, these are the days of film, you know,
sure.
not lightweight cameras. And were it not for the fact that the white hunter shot her, you know, she would have come and trampled me to death. It was extraordinary. And what's even more amazing is that as she died, she held in her gaze, she stared at me, And I saw this glaze coming over her eyes, and then her front legs crumpled, and she fell on her side, looking at me all the time until the life in her eyes vanished. And I had the most incredible feeling that somehow or another she made a connection with me. And then later on, many, many, many years later, when I went back to Africa to try and find some healing for an illness that I developed here in L.A., the shamans would throw the bones and say, "What is this elephant that we see around you?" You know, it's as though the spirit was with me for the rest of my life. And she's still with me now.
Well, and I think I know who the friend of the most evil man ever was. But you have to, since you mentioned that before, you got to give us, for people who don't know, I think I picked that up from something else, that that you got to know a pilot or something, right?
Correct. I was doing a film on the history of South African Airways. We're talking about the 1980s now.
Right.
1983. And the story of the airline goes right back to 1929. And in the early 30s, they ordered, it was originally privately owned, it didn't work, so the guy was taken, his airline was taken over by the South African government and renamed South African Airways. Prior to that, it was called Union Airways, and then it became South African Airways in 1934. And they ordered three new aircraft from a German factory, from the Junkers factory in Germany. Now, in the early 30s, flying brand new aircraft down the length of darkest Africa, where there were no navigational aids, very few airfields, very few places to refuel airplanes, was in itself a major expedition, a major adventure to do that. And one of the pilots of one of these delivery flights, bringing out this new aircraft, was a guy from Germany, of course. And he flew this aircraft all the way down to Johannesburg. It took like 2 weeks to fly all the way down Africa. There were adventures along the way, which I write about in the book. And he eventually arrived in South Africa, delivered the airplane. And when I got the job to do this series on the history of SAA, I learned through our researchers that this guy was still alive. He was in his late 80s, but he was still alive, living in Bavaria in Germany. And not only that, but that he had taken film of that delivery flight in the early 30s. So of course, I'm putting together this documentary series, and I said, I got to interview this guy.
Right.
And I've got to use the footage from that film. And so eventually we ended up in Germany as part of the production on that particular series, and I met the man, and it turns out that he was Adolf Hitler's personal pilot.
For a guy who, which is interesting, because Hitler hated to fly.
He hated flying. The only time he would ever fly was when this guy, Hans Baur was his name, B-A-U-R, was at the controls of the aircraft. Other than that, he didn't like flying at all, as you correctly say. But if Hans Baur was at the controls, he would do that. And he and Hans Baur were like bosom buddies. And when Hans Baur got married, Hitler gave him his wedding party in his apartment in Munich. And they were close right up until the day Hitler locked himself up in the bunker in Berlin and took his life. And Hans Baur was at that, in the bunker that night with him, and escaped before Hitler shot himself and gave Eva Braun the poison.
So, I mean, I don't have much time here, but he was a committed Nazi then, right?
Well, I never questioned that. And I would have had to have been. I was told by, we had a representative from the German government who accompanied us to interview this guy and a whole lot of other, you know, important people. And I was told, you ask nothing about the Second World War. You do not discuss that.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm not interested in that. I want to know about that delivery flight in the 1930s.
Well, that's fair. But I could understand why it'd be a touchy subject. But nobody made it into those final days unless they were tightly in the inner circle and highly vetted. So that makes me suspicious about that. But still, so interesting, and thank you so much. We got more to come. You can join the conversation with Lionel Friedberg next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll go to open lines coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM. But let's, again, we're going to keep it off from the political sphere. I'll leave that up to more capable minds than mine. But we will have open lines, which means that, you know, other than politics and, you know, the re-arguing of things that you might have heard on other radio shows this week, it's going to be pretty much wherever you're going to take us coming up. And we can go a couple of different directions here, too, next with our guest, Lionel Friedberg, so we can talk about shamanism, African shamanism. We can talk about Hollywood, because he hinted at some stories, too, that he didn't drill very deeply down on. And if anybody knows those secret stories of Hollywood, it's going to be Lionel. Coming up tomorrow night, first hour on Coast to Coast, Alan Kalinge will join us again. We'll talk about the proposals that exist and could very well happen in the first quarter of 2021, where there could be debt relief in the form of loan forgiveness for college students who are finding it pretty hard to get a job, but have been suffering for a long time under these draconian interest rates that the government should really have no business applying to its own citizens. And Dr. George Pratt, who was on not that long ago, but I think it's important to have him back on again to talk about the code to joy, the four-step solution to unlocking your natural state of happiness. That'll be both coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. In the meantime, we're lining up your calls, and we'll get to you next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Lionel Friedberg is in between books. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Find out more about that book, by the way, about South African Airways. Also, Full Service, My Adventures in Hollywood and the Secret Sex Lives of the Stars. And the one that's coming up, Forever in My Veins, How Film Led Me to the Mysterious World of the African Shaman. Enjoying so much of the stories we're talking about. Before we go to the phone, so I had an interesting comment that came in on Twitter. So at Deacon Punnett, if you want to follow me there. And it sort of ties in both the subject of Scotty Bowers, who had been the subject of your book Full Service, who had witnessed so much, you know, of the horrors of war before opening up this escort service in L.A. in the 1940s. And the shaman piece. And it was this from Barbara, who just asked whether there's anything to the idea of what shamans can do for people who suffer from PTSD. She said, in soldiers actually being spirits of the dead soldiers who were near them when they died. Is this ever come up to you?
Well, I wouldn't use the term PTSD, but I have witnessed many, many occasions where the shamans of Southern Africa, and by the way, they go under the name of Sangomas in South Africa. So if anyone has ever heard the name, the word Sangoma, that means a shaman who is a fortune teller, a diviner, a herbalist, you know, does many, many things and basically connects with the spiritual realm in order to fix things, heal things, see things, diagnose things down here on the earth plane. That's the modus operandi that they work for. But what I have seen is many, many times people have consulted Sangomas in South Africa, and I've witnessed this, and I've actually filmed this, where people have been put in touch with their ancestors, someone who's passed away, a mother or a child or a husband who was either killed in a mining accident or didn't come back after having been imprisoned and during the worst days of apartheid. That happened quite a lot. And so in terms of PTSD, you didn't see much of that because that's a sort of, I guess, the way we think about it here would be, you know, wartime trauma.
Right.
And so you didn't find that there because, remember, no blacks would have been in the military in South Africa at all. But every white young male over the age of 18 was conscripted for 2 years of military service. And there was sure a lot of PTSD because a lot of those young guys actually saw service in Angola when Angola was occupied by the Cubans in an effort to try to get independence for what is now Namibia, what used to be known as Southwest Africa, which was under the control of South Africa. So South African troops, soldiers who doing their natural military service were often sent up there to fight the battles in order to prevent a black government from taking power in Namibia. And there were many, many deaths and many, many traumatic conditions. And it was all-out war on the border. And they would come back with horrifying stresses and disorders.
Yeah, and I know I was making the connection to Scotty Bowers, but, you know, PTSD doesn't have to be about war at all. It can often be a woman who was attacked.
Absolutely.
Right? Being just post-traumatic stress, would a shaman work well with somebody who had been the victim of date rape or somebody who had suffered from a horrible car accident?
The answer to that is an absolute yes. Either by dispensing some kind of medicine, usually a combination of herbs and whatever else, but also by doing rituals. And when I consulted many, many shamans, I developed a kidney disorder here in the mid-1990s. I was working on a television series called Histories, Mysteries, and Mysteries of the Bible.
Right. And, both of which I love, by the way.
And I suddenly became really, really ill, and no one could figure it out. And my doctor said to me, you better go and see a kidney specialist or a heart specialist because there's something really wrong with you. And I went to see a nephrologist, and we did a biopsy. And so it turned out that I was suffering from a kidney disorder. It was an autoimmune disorder. My immune system was basically attacking my kidneys. It was called an idiopathic condition is the medical term. In other words, they have no idea why it's happening.
Right.
And I have a friend who's a surgeon who actually studied the ways of the shaman in South Africa. White guy, also South African, and he said to me, you know, I'm going back to South Africa to do some more research. Why don't you come with me? Maybe those guys have an answer for you. And I said, Dave, you're asking me. You're a surgeon. You work in a major hospital in Santa Barbara, and you want me to go to South Africa and go and see some guy living in a hut and throw some bones, and you expect me to find a cure? And he said, yeah, I absolutely do. And I did. I went back with him. And I met many, many shamans. But I also did a series prior to that on the tribes of South Africa where I met shamans, although I didn't have a kidney disorder. But when I developed this disease, those shamans, everyone without exception, after having thrown the bone, said, yeah, there's something wrong with your internal organs, with your kidneys. They saw it immediately. It was in the bones. Because the way they see this is that my ancestors are affecting or impacting the way the bones fall on the grass mat. And the way the bones fall, whether it's upside down or the right way up, depending on the type of bone, the Sangoma can interpret that. And, you know, without exception, they said, you have a major kidney disease, and we can help you. And so they dispensed powders and all sorts of things and for ritual baths. Well, you know, I should have been on dialysis years ago, and I'm still going strong.
I love that. Well,
my nephrologist, who's only recently retired, he said, I don't know how come you've actually done as well as you have all these years, but, you know, you're still around and you're incredible. I don't know what it is. And I said, well, you'll never believe it. I gave him a copy of my book. He read it, and he called me back, and he said, you have changed my life. You have really have changed the way I see the world. I had no idea. And, you know, I often used to tell him that I'd go to Africa, and I saw shamans. But he wasn't interested in that until he read my book.
Love that. Well, I've got some people hanging on who want to jump in with questions, and we want to keep them before we lose them at the top of the hour. So let's get to Vicky, west of the Rockies in Juneau on Coast to Coast AM. Vicky?
Well, hi-dee-ho.
Hi.
Hi, Vicky.
Hi, Ian. We haven't talked since we talked about sea stories up here in Alaska. That was in 2010.
Well, wow, that has been a while, and you would be. It's. I'm glad to hear you sound like you're in good health and that you're still up in the middle of the night. So happy to have you.
Believe it.
I love that.
56 years old now, and I have a question for Mr. I think it's Goldstein. Is that right?
No, Friedberg. But go ahead.
Oh, Friedberg. I just want to know how in the world. Did you get the answers from Adolf Hitler about what went on in the bunker or anywhere around it?
Well, as it was told to me by his personal pilot when I met him at his home in Munich when I was making the documentary series, he said that he was with Hitler that night and he pleaded with Hitler to leave the bunker and come with him and that he would fly him to safety, either to an Arab country or a South American country. And Hitler said, no, forget about it. The war is over. It's finished. My job is done. It's not going to work. I'm going to take my own life here tonight. And in actual fact, he presented this man that I was talking to, Hans Bahr. He gave him one of his favorite oil paintings, which he took out of the frame, and he said, "You roll this up, put it in your backpack. This is a gift from me for you to remember me, but I'm taking my life tonight. Eva and I are dying in this bunker tonight. Get out of here." And so he left. And that night, while running through the streets, the Russian troops were invading Berlin, and he got shot, and he eventually became a prisoner of war with the Russians. And the Russians always believed that he knew what had happened to Hitler. And they kind of tried to squeeze out of him the fact that maybe Hitler did not take his life, and that he escaped, and that he went to some country in South America. But as far as he was concerned, he said, "No, the Führer told me it's the end of the line for him tonight. He's taking his life."
Did he get to keep the painting?
He got to keep the painting. The Russians, of course, took it away.
Oh, okay. That's what I meant. The Russians didn't give it back to him.
No. Okay. And his war wounds, when I met him, he came down the staircase of his little house in Amersfoort, a very nice little picture book house, you know, clunk, clunk, clunk. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, what's wrong with the guy's leg? And he realized afterwards, once he told me his life story, because at the end of the interview, he called for all the photograph books, and he showed me his albums about what had happened during the war, and pictures of him and Hitler with Goebbels and Mussolini and so on. And he said, "The Russians shot me right here in my leg, and that is why, and they bungled the surgery, and that's why I have this war wound today." He was totally open and honest. He didn't hold anything back.
First time caller line, Oscar is in Dallas for Lionel Friedberg. The book that's coming out is called Forever in My Veins, How Film Led Me to the Mysterious World of the African Shaman. Oscar?
Yeah, am I here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just had a quick question, man, and I'm trying to make sure everybody understands this, but when you guys talk about white privilege, are you guys talking about also the farmers are dying in South Africa right now? Because I feel it's a little messed up. You guys aren't bringing that up.
It's really not that kind of a show, Oscar. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an apartheid when the smaller percentage of white people in the country were in charge of everybody. So what you raise here or trying to sneak into the conversation is about something else, which is not about what we were talking about earlier. Mike is in Mississippi, wildcard line on Coast to Coast AM. Mike?
Hey, man. How you guys doing?
Doing all right. You're talking with Lionel Friedberg.
Nice to meet you.
I
would like to add a little bit to your story of your shaman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. My daddy, he was very sick when he was little. Okay. My grandfather took him to see this little old lady that lived outside of our hometown. Her name was Marnie.
Right.
And she was some type of shaman, more gypsy-like. Anyway, she told my granddaddy a couple of, you know, neat things about my daddy. Said that he was going to be some type of entertainer or something like that. But he was real sick, and at the time, he was like an experiment. He had to have open heart surgery when he was real young, like at about 12 years old.
Right.
She said that he would be some type of entertainer. So anyway, they had the surgery. Daddy grew up. His wife wound up being kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But he didn't realize it at the time that he was doing everything that she had told my pepaw that he would do. Like with the entertaining thing, he would do charities for the March of Dimes. Mm-hmm. He would do haunted houses during Halloween.
Yeah.
So that was kind of entertaining at the time.
Cool.
But then he graduated from that to doing sideshows, and he traveled with the Willinda Circus for a little while. Then he would do SCA demonstrations and stuff. Now, these were all things that he was doing, you know, just to pass time and as jobs and things like that. So he didn't realize, well, you know, until later on, he was like, you know, I did everything that she said I would do.
That's kind of the interesting thing about shamanism sometimes, isn't it? But Lionel, what's your response to that?
Well, my response to that is that shamanism exists all over the world. And here in North America, you know, the indigenous tribes had amazingly powerful shamans, as they still do in many, many countries in South America. Peru comes to mind immediately, as does Brazil. You find shamans in every society all over the world. They may have different methods of operating and different methods of interpreting things. But it is what it tells us is that there's more than we know. There's more than what our Western society believes in, that the world is a much more complex and different and more amazing place than we've been taught or that we've been, you know, exposed to. And this doesn't surprise me. I've met amazing shamans in North America, by the way. When I did a show for National Geographic some years back, I hired some actors to perform in a cave sequence. And these guys were from the Lakota tribe. And the one guy was a very, very, very powerful shaman. He just looked at you, and he looked right through you, and he could see
right.
what you were about. And I knew that, you know. And I've experienced the same thing in Africa and to a lesser degree in Ecuador and in Brazil. But, you know, shamanism exists all over the world. It's not just about Western allopathic medicine. There is so much more.
And yet, I think to even go back to what you were talking about with your friend, the surgeon from Santa Barbara, that so often what we do have is when American pharmaceuticals or international pharmaceutical companies are looking for new medicines, they go to Africa. They often go around specifically into jungles, and they look for some of these things which the locals have known and sworn by for years.
Well,
and they try centuries and try to figure out, like, what's the connection here?
Exactly. Exactly. Most of our medicines come from the natural world. You know, that's where it comes from. Of course, there are other cocktails that they concoct in labs and so on. But most of the medication that we've been using for a very, very long time come from the natural kingdom. That's where they find it.
You know, you brought up your show on biblical mysteries, mysteries of the Bible that you had worked on for so long. Well, that's a series is only on for a brief period of time. I swear to you, I saw every one of those episodes.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah. But one of those, interestingly enough, one of those things from the Bible, which people don't quite understand, because there's so many references to casting lots.
Yes.
Which isn't that different from the way you describe, you know, rolling the bones on the hut floor, because although we don't know exactly what casting lots meant, we know it was a kind of there was a belief that however it was being interpreted, this is what God wanted. And so it was the belief that God chose which items were up and which ones were down, and that's how something would be chosen. It wasn't incompatible with the idea of divine revelation. Well, that's where we'll leave it. But I'd love to have you back sometime. And I know when the new book comes out, you'll get me a copy of it. And we can pick up this conversation where we left off. And I hope by then, too, we've got good news about your new movie version of your other book as well. Find out more by going to Lionel Friedberg's website. You can hook up to him at coasttocoastam.com. We'll give you the numbers. It's open lines next. Where do you want to take the show? We'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.